Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take up Sandhill Cranes to begin the program today. You know, about 100 years ago, Sandhill Cranes had nearly disappeared from Wisconsin's landscape. They've made a comeback so significant they are blamed for causing significant crop damage. And with us today are three members of the legislative study committee that was formed to look at Sandhill Cranes and act on some proposals relating to them. One of the people is with us. Who is with us is Paul Waite. Paul is communications manager for the Delta Waterfowl Foundation. Paul, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, appreciate your presence. Melissa Johnson, another of our guests, is the executive director of Wisconsin's Green Fire. Melissa, thank you for joining in.
My absolute pleasure, Larry.
And Todd Schaller is the board of directors of both the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association and the Wisconsin Conservation and Education Foundation. Todd, thank you for joining in.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
As we talk with our three guests, who were both all three citizen members of the committee, I hope you'll join in. Give us a thought. Give us a call about your thoughts on Sandhill Cranes. Number's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. Just by way of a sort of a general introduction, legislative study committees, in my understanding, are held every 2 years on a handful of topics. They typically develop one or more draft bills for possible introduction to the legislature. And the committee you served on, the 12-member legislative study committee, had to do with Sandhill Cranes. I think there were four legislators, two Democrats and two Republicans, and eight citizen members from conservation and farming groups. So that's kind of the background of the committee. Melissa, what was the committee's overall charge?
Oh, excuse me. Thank you for asking. The overall charge was to evaluate, my understanding at least, to evaluate the potential for a hunt of sandhill cranes, and in particular, with a rationale underscoring the damage that the cranes are doing to crops, particularly corn. They apparently like the seed very, very much, and their habitat is adjacent to cornfields. So that was my understanding and my interest in trying to balance that interest of our farming community and, of course, our conservation community. So that's what initiated all of the discussion over the course of several months.
Yeah, you met five times. I read a piece from Paul Smith, who was writing for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he said, "Testimony over the first three meetings made it clear that there would be no easy or complete solutions." Paul,
as
what
with
was
all sticky solutions? Ahead. There isn't. I'm sorry.
No, yeah. That's all right, Melissa. It was a tough time.
It was.
Paul, a comment on that? I mean, you must have heard some pretty impassioned talks from people on all sides of the issue.
We did, but we also heard, you know, a lot of science from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, from the Wisconsin DNR, from the International Crane Foundation, and other interested groups. You know, so we got a really good dive into, you know, the population dynamics of cranes. And then also we heard from farm groups and about the damage that was being caused by cranes. And so, you know, I think we, you know, I was privileged to be on this committee. We got a real good, well-rounded look at not only the problem, if you will, but we got to look under the hood of what sandhill cranes are doing in Wisconsin. So And certainly there's passion on a lot of people's part, both for and against the hunt. And, you know, part of the charge here was to figure out what we could do to help the state's farmers.
Yeah. How significant is the problem, the crop damage problem by sandhill cranes, Paul?
Yeah, so what we heard was that conservatively, it's right around $1.9 million a year damage to crops. About half of that was corn, and then almost half was potatoes, but there were some other things too, wheat and cranberries and a few other fruit, beans, I guess, some other crops. And the amount of damage is growing. Along with the population of cranes, it's also growing. So this situation is continuing to be worse and worse for farmers. And, you know, so that's why I believe the study committee was formed, was to try to find solutions to help the farmers out and also to provide hunting opportunity if the resource can sustain it. And we found out that it can.
Yeah, and Todd, to get you involved here, the you voted on a few draft bills. What were the bills that you voted on?
There was, you know, three bills that were kind of talked through. One was a standalone reimbursement program, cost share for Avapel. The second one was a bill that would authorize hunting, and then thus by authorizing hunting, it would open up the agricultural depredation program. And then the third was really those two bills in combination. And that's the bill that we ultimately voted in support of, 8-4 with some amendments. But those were the three bills. So it's three bills, but all very similar. Like I said, two standalone, and then the one kind of taking a more multi-strategy approach to the conversation and the challenge.
Yeah, Melissa, just I don't know how much you know about the history, but a century ago, sandhill cranes, as I mentioned earlier, were almost hunted out of existence. Their comeback has been monumental.
Well, I'm not quite 100 years old, but
no, neither am
some
I.
People think, yeah, but I remember growing up in Wisconsin, and I never saw a sandhill crane. And I remember the first time seeing one here in central Wisconsin where I live. And it was, you know, a stunning moment. And conservation efforts, obviously, have worked. And I'm ever so grateful for that, because I'd like my grandchildren and my grandchildren's grandchildren to enjoy these birds. So, you know, kudos to everybody who put that early work into ensuring their protection. Of course, Endangered Species Act underpins a lot of that, and we need to ensure its vitality. I just want to add in one thing. The one thing we did learn, and I asked this question very, very early on, I think it was your first meeting, and I asked it of DNR, former DNR person, will a spring hunt or a hunt in the fall impact corn damage in the spring? And the answer was no. So I think there was this early kind of division of how do we best address corn damage and then pull apart that hunting sort of concept. So the two were linked in our mission, our charge,
sure.
But we quickly pulled them apart as separate issues.
And I understand farmers can get depredation permits to shoot sandhill cranes in their fields. Is that, and of course, that is taking care of a problem right when it happens, but is this not enough?
Yeah, absolutely. They can get depredation permits, and that's one of the contentious things for me, actually. So, not that I want farmers not to have a remedy or a method, but yeah, in 2023, 1,405 sandhill cranes were killed under depredation permits in Wisconsin, which was what we learned. And because of Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the way the federal government handles things, those birds cannot be utilized. So the farmer who shoots them to get them to stop damaging their corn crop, they have to leave the bird lay in the field or throw it in the dumpster. They cannot utilize those birds. So, and that number, the number of birds that are being taken on those damage permits continues to rise.
Hmm. Well, so, somebody mentioned, maybe it was you, Todd, that mentioned Avapel. Can you talk about Avapel and applied to corn seed?
Sure. I mean, Avapel is a product that has been produced that is basically put on the seed. A farmer puts it on the seed prior to planting. And then because ultimately the spring damage from cranes is basically they're actually eating the corn seed itself. So they use that big long bill and stick it down and grab that corn seed when it's still kind of in that early stages of seed. So Avapel is a deterrent to that, that has some effect in, a crane that, grabs a seed or two, or, we think we heard variety of numbers, but doesn't like that taste and then quits feeding on that product. So it has some effectiveness. International Crane Foundation was part in kind of developing and testing it. Obviously, it comes at a cost to farmers, and we learned about that cost. So it's additional cost, which from an agricultural perspective impacts their bottom line. And in the ag world, when you're working on tight margins to begin with, anything that adds additional cost obviously shrinks that and makes that margin even tighter.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to take a quick little break here. Paul Waite, Senior Manager of Communications for Delta Waterfowl and editor of the organization's magazine, Melissa Johnson, Executive Director of Wisconsin's Green Fire, and Todd Schaller, Board President of the Wisconsin Conservation and Education Foundation, all members of the 12-member Legislative Study Committee on Sandhill Cranes. We'll give you a chance to join in now. If you'd like to weigh in, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. We're talking about sandhill cranes and the legislative study committee on sandhill cranes. Three members of the committee, Paul Waite, Melissa Johnson, and Todd Schaller, are guests today, and they were all citizen members of that committee. Questions, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Karen emailed to say Karen watched or attended all five of the Sandhill Crane Legislative Committee meetings and as a result has two questions. Number one, why weren't the changes that were discussed and agreed upon during the fourth meeting not added to the summary of findings? And two, there's a list of ways that the items in the summary were misrepresented, not totally factual, or missing context. Why was this list not included in the summary? Melissa, we'll turn to you first.
Sure, we can do a round robin with that. So the summary of the findings were really a product of the chair's notes and a couple of other people's notes. They weren't an official summary coming from the legislative staff. And I think probably as with all notes, and I'm just going to be fair here, sometimes we miss things in notes and we miss context. We were presented with a lot of information. The notes, I think, did miss necessary context. There was information from Ann Lacey, who works for the Crane Foundation, who tried to clarify things, and then Mr. Jeb Barzan, an expert in crane biology. So I'm not sure we had asked for them to be included in, and ultimately those corrections were, or that additional context was not approved for ultimately including in the official record. I voted to oppose adding it to the official record because it was not produced by legislative staff. It was produced as a part of notes. So, oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Paul, anything to add to that?
Yeah. So that wasn't really up to, you know, that was the chair of the committee that kind of steered that and decided that. But I also would note that if you do go to the website, all of Ann Lacey's comments are in a document in there. So they are part of the work product of the meetings. So it's not like they were erased from the record. They are there. But you do have to search for them and find that specific document to find those, that extra context. I think part of what happened was we just, as a committee, we didn't want to spend more time debating some of the points that were put forward and some of that context and definitions of words and languages and things. So I think that's what happened, but I can't speak for the entire group, but that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah. Todd, anything to add there?
No, I would agree. I think that's kind of, particularly in the fourth meeting, you know, we were trying to work our way through it, and it was clear, I guess, that was probably going to take all of the fourth meeting and maybe five and six and seven to kind of come to a final consensus. But so the focus turned to the bills that were drafted at that point in time and kind of work through that. Because if you look at what we were asked to do, that really is, you know, was the ask is, you know, propose potential legislation to provide some management strategies for sandhill cranes, looking at agricultural damage and, you know, a hunting opportunity and all that. So I think in the end, that part was accomplished, and that was our primary charge.
Yeah. Timothy and Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks, Timothy, for calling.
Morning, Larry. Yes, I have a couple of just thoughts here I'd like to mention for the gentleman that, you know, sandhill cranes are really special to a lot of people here in Wisconsin, and I think especially anybody who's read a Sand County Almanac. And I did attend most of those meetings, so I had a chance to sit in and listen to the testimony and found that it was very heavily weighed towards the comments of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, which has been promoting the season all year. Now, I'm a hunter and an avid waterfowl hunter, but the only testimony that I heard really that was invited from the public was with the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology, and I wish they would have invited many of the hunters who are opposed to a hunting season. And I guess I would just ask the guests here, number one, why would they vote for a bill that would require the state to have a season but not allow it to go through the Natural Resources Board, which is where most of our hunting seasons are set? And why would they not consider that since wildlife belongs to all of us, the crop damage law, in essence, it requires a hunting season in order to pay crop damage to farmers. Why would they not consider a bill which would allow general tax money to pay for that and not require a hunting season? So I'd be interested in how the gentlemen know what they think about that. Thank you, Larry.
All right. Thank you for calling. So I'm not sure who wants to take that to begin with.
Larry, I'll maybe
Todd
start the conversation.
Sure.
Sure. So Tim's very aware of the process for establishing seasons. And the first step of that process is for the legislature to authorize the ability for a season. The next step is, and that the legislation as it's laid out, then turns it over to the Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and on the Department of Natural Resources, the Natural Resource Board, to help establish what that season looks like. So we don't in Wisconsin, the Natural Resource Board is part of the rulemaking process, but they also have to be provided the authority to look at that. So, you know, if this continues to move forward, the Natural Resource Board and the DNR rulemaking process will be involved in part of that. So I think that's, you know, that's like that or not, that is the process we have in the state of Wisconsin. So that addresses the first part of what Tim had indicated. And, you know, I guess to add on that, that then includes additional public input process. So that's a, I believe, a win in all our minds. So, you know, the fact that, you know, not everybody would support or hunters support or don't support or would hunt or not hunt really isn't the question that we were tasked with. It was to develop some management strategies addressing agricultural damage for sandhill cranes. I think part of that is we also need to recognize that if we have a constitutional right in Wisconsin to hunt, fish, and trap. So we need to keep that in mind as we continue to talk about this. And I'm a hunter too, but I don't hunt all species. And I don't necessarily like the way we do hunt some species. But I'm not going to engage in prohibiting that if it's one, sound management to hunt that species, authorized by law to hunt that species. Again, I fall back to the constitutional aspect of that.
Yeah. Melissa, care to chime in?
Sure. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Todd, for your response. And thanks, Tim, for the question. First of all, I did not vote in favor of the bill. I voted against it for a number of reasons. But I just want to quickly say that the constitutional right that Todd spoke about is very clear. But it is subject only to reasonable restrictions as prescribed by law. And I'm reading right from the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It's kind of why we don't hunt raptors like hawks and eagles and owls. So there's always got to be a reasonable framework by which our rights are granted to us. Early on, I had just indicated that we learned that a sandhill crane hunt would have little to no impact on the corn depredation for farmers. So then I had asked myself, what is the problem we're trying to fix? And it was apparent that there were some people interested in a crane hunt. I understand that. I used to be a hunter. I'm not anymore. I don't have time, and it's rather expensive. But in that, we should have a management plan. And in 2009, there was a management plan for sandhill crane. Again, talking about it's their populations, and if we were to have a hunt, what should that population be at? That plan was supposed to be updated every 5 years. It has not been updated in 15 years. And in 15 years, we know that things have changed. And what we were hearing from our experts is that the population seems to be leveling off for whatever reason. We have some inconsistencies with how we measure the crane population using a couple of different methodologies, and that's fine. But, you know, in 2024, the crane population was counted at 83,649 birds, yet in 2023, it was counted at 111,639. So, and this is from the Fish and Wildlife Service. So we know there's data gaps. I'm not opposed to a hunt. What I'm opposed to is a lack of an updated management plan to help guide that. And that's done by DNR and experts. So again, not opposed to a hunt. I hope this discussion will net itself an updated crane management plan.
Ah, all right. Paul, did you want to add anything as well?
Yeah, so the Fish and Wildlife Service data on the eastern population of sandhill cranes that was released on the 20th of August in their status update that they put out every year says that there's 110,000 sandhill cranes and that it increased 4% from the previous year, and it's been increasing at a rate of 4.4%. annually. So I'm not sure where the 83,000 number comes from. I've never seen that number. That was not presented to us by any of the experts either. So I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to dispute you on that, Lisa. and it also, the population, as we were told by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and DNR folks, is not really leveling off. It's expanding outside of Wisconsin. The eastern population of sandhill cranes is expanding in range and size and number. So, yeah, I'm not sure where that 83,000 thing came from. But,
I thank you for your comments as well. Mark in Neosho has something that relates to kind of what all we've been talking about here the last few minutes. Mark, comments?
Good morning, Larry. Thanks, everyone, for allowing me to participate. First of all, I've been involved in migratory conservation and the rule process for over 35 years. I think I have a fairly good understanding. And one of the things that's important is that 83% of the Wisconsin voters supported the constitutional right to hunt, fish, and trap and take game, only subject, like Melissa said, to reasonable restrictions. Melissa's comments in regards to raptors are irrelevant because there's no season, nor can there be a season on raptors. And one of the things that there is, that there is no clause that says, except for if there is a legal hunting season or can be a legal hunting season, it was the basis of that constitutional act. The second thing is a question and fact sheet was submitted by David Scott from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that eliminated any question by reasonable doubt in regards to whether or not an updated management plan should have any impact on whether or not Wisconsin has a sandhill crane season. And I think the exact verbiage in that article was, to the question, absolutely not. Now, I don't know what science or whose science people have used to refute the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but it's important to understand that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is the acknowledged professional and authority on migratory birds, right? They are the ones that set the guidelines, as well as the rule and framework that the flyway uses to create these hunting seasons. And, you know, when it comes to the representation on this committee, you know, Greenfire, part of their mission statement is the support of science-based management of natural resources. One of the folks on their or in their organization served on the Migratory Council for well over 20 years, and I'm sure that person would not doubt the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service science on the matter. And I think that if everybody looked at that question and answer statement, these questions have clear answers, and they're supported by everybody in the flyway.
All right. Mark brings a lot to the discussion here, and I'd like to get some response or at least comments from everybody. Melissa, start with you, I guess.
Certainly. Let's start with, there is no biological reason to not have a hunt, okay? There is no biological reason to have a hunt. I mean, if that's the starting point. Moving from there, the science, deciding to have a hunt is really a political, social, and cultural decision, right? Mm-hmm. It is typically rooted in our history and our traditions and, of course, the framework of law. From a science perspective, the Fish and Wildlife Service did say, yeah, there have you can support a hunt up to, I think it was about 4%. But then we also got a piece of our document from an individual who was part of the Eastern Flyway Planning, a professor out of Tennessee, who said that it's important to update that information because of the way we measure the population and some of the other factors, like a lower fledge rate than we used to have. And it's that measurement. We are using a couple of different ways to measure the population at different locations. And that's where we get this range, everywhere from that low point to the high point I just mentioned. So again, the science comes in, the data comes in, and the work of Greenfire, like I said, I am not opposed to it. I would love to see that updated plan. I don't like the cart before the horse. I think if we had an updated plan, I think some of the reservations of some folks might go away, because we can reassure through that updated plan that we're doing no harm, that we're doing the best job possible for this incredible species.
Yeah. Paul, we'll have you chime in. Paul?
Yeah. So just the Fish and Wildlife Service has, or did let the committee know that they are working on that update to the plan. Another point here is that in the current management plan, the threshold to have a hunt was established at 30,000 cranes in the eastern population. And again, this is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service numbers. They said that the eastern population of sandhill cranes is at 110,000. So we're 3.7 times that threshold on the low end to have a hunt. And the population, again, continues to increase by 4% per year of the eastern population of sandhill cranes. So we're way above a threshold at which a hunting season could happen, and also would possibly, you know, cause any concern of anyone about that as far as what a hunt might do. You got to understand, too, the hunt that would be authorized for Wisconsin, and this is, again, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the DNR, would result in maybe 1,000 or so cranes being harvested a year. And for me, we're shooting 1,400 of them in the spring and leaving them lay in a cornfield. And as a hunter and a conservationist, that hurts me a little bit. I'd like to be able to utilize that resource in a constructive way as a huntable species. And also, they're excellent table fare. So I would like the opportunity in Wisconsin to have a hunt here. And by the way, cranes are hunted in 17 states of the United States currently, and also two or three Canadian provinces. So it's not that Wisconsin would be, you know, breaking new ground here to have a hunting season for sandhill cranes.
Yeah. And Todd, anything to add to what Melissa and Paul have said?
The only thing I'd add is, as Paul indicated, in the David Scott from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, that indicated that they're underway of developing a new plan or an updated plan. What underway means in the federal government, you know, we're all probably not sure. But I think one thing to keep in mind is this process, our process to establish a season in Wisconsin, is a very long process. So first off, you know, we've just kicked a bill out of a study committee for consideration in the political process. If that moves just through our political process, that's probably a year plus. If that gets approved, the department has to establish a management plan and a hunt plan that ultimately needs to be approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's another probably year to two, probably two minimum, on top of that. So we have, even if we were to streamline this through the system, there's probably 2 plus 3 years before we would ever have a hunt in Wisconsin. Hopefully, like Melissa and others, hopefully the Fish and Wildlife Service has established or reestablished that plan renewed that plan. And if at any point there was concerns or red flags, that would be identified, and it would be. And then we would either have to step back or modify what that hunt looks like. So I think we all want the plan updated, but we also, even moving forward with this concept, we have time for that plan to be updated and then obviously implemented or influenced what the end product looks like.
Let's give Linda and Cable a chance to join in. Linda, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I missed the beginning of your program, but I want to put in my nickel's worth. I live out in the woods, but I have two huge fields on either side of my driveway. And every spring, these redheaded cranes come, and they hang out for like 3 weeks. And they are such a pleasure to watch because they're doing their mating dance. And I just put on some symphony music and watch them because I stay home and I can sew and watch them. And it's such a pleasure, and I hope they don't slaughter them all and I can still see them till I die.
All right, Linda, thanks for calling. I don't know if anybody wants to chime in on that. Melissa, you want to chime?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Linda, I'd love to come up to Cable and sit on your front porch and listen to the music and watch the birds.
Todd, you were going to say something.
Yeah, and same thing. I think, you know, everybody on the committee, you know, is one recognizes the uniqueness of the sandhill cranes, the amazing conservation story that comes with the sandhill cranes. And I think in the end, even if Wisconsin were to have a hunt, I think understand that from the day-to-day perspective of enjoying cranes, seeing cranes fly, listening to your music while watching them there with their breeding dance, that probably doesn't change. You know, it doesn't change at all because the current structure under the current management plan is the harvest would be very managed, very controlled. And again, on a day-to-day perspective, we're going to continue to see cranes, enjoy cranes, you know, all times of the year in Wisconsin, and particularly with our warming winters, even now, I've been seeing cranes the last several days in Wisconsin, even though we're in the heart of winter and they should be down south.
Yeah, I've been seeing them too. It's always an amazing sight for sure. Stephen Stoughton had something. We'll give him a chance to join in. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning, and thank you. Look, I don't understand why a crane hunt is tied to an ag bill. At all. The premise is that cranes cause damage to the corn farmers, but I looked at the numbers and apparently it's $2 million worth of damage a year, but our corn harvest is like $2 billion a year. And so that's like a 0.1%. So I don't really think that 0.1% is really harming when the value of the cranes are so high. So that's one thing. But secondly, what an embarrassment to the state to hunt an animal just because it seems we love to hunt. But to hunt an animal when we have an international foundation in Baraboo that is world renowned, has global impacts. And to me, that's an embarrassment for Wisconsin to allow a hunt when we're out here trying to protect them and save them and having a global impact.
Well, Steve, I thank you very much for calling. Paul, we haven't gone to you for a bit here. Let's go to you.
Yeah, so I want to say this. I love sandhill cranes, too. And yes, I have hunted them, not in Wisconsin, obviously, because we don't have a season here. I grew up and spent a lot of time as a kid near Clintonville, at a cranberry bog marsh, and I love to watch the cranes, and I still do in the spring and every month of the year. So even though I'm a hunter, I relish that opportunity. And like Todd said before, we're not going to, as a hunting community, we're not going to, someone used the word slaughter. This isn't a slaughter. It's a very carefully managed and regulated hunting opportunity for people in Wisconsin. And I love that the International Crane Foundation is in my home state. You know, people can be both hunters and birders and enjoy wildlife in many different ways. And so I'm one of those people who do.
Well, Paul, thanks for your comment back, and we need to take a little break here. So just a reminder, we're coming back, but our guests, Paul Waite, Melissa Johnson, and Todd Schall are all members of that legislative committee that looked at the situation regarding our cranes here in the state. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Big thanks to everyone who donated during our year-end member drives. It's support from people like Melody in Verona or Jolene in Chippewa Falls who make WPR's essential service possible. If you missed joining in, still time at WPR.org. And when you do, you can ask for your WPR wool socks for $15 a month as well. Thanks so much for your partnership during our member year-end member drive. Visiting about Sandhill Cranes and the legislative committee that looked at coming up with some proposals that we've discussed for hunting sandhill cranes and for providing financial support to farmers who lost money as a part of the depredation by sandhill cranes. Our last caller did mention something about the corn itself and sort of comparing the loss versus the amount of money that comes through corn production here in our state as being kind of small and insignificant. But Todd, you want to have a comment relating to that?
Well, I mean, I think on a global scale, national scale, maybe that is the question. But when you look at the individual farmer who is impacted by this and their livelihood depends upon it, that's a difference. And as I said, their margins to, you know, in the agricultural community is razor thin. And when you have additional costs or by adding Avapel or other costs associated with your product, and then you have losses, that's significant. And that has a direct impact on families, individuals, and Wisconsin has a strong agricultural community. So,
Dana in Shell Lake has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dana.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. So I was wondering if a sandhill crane hunt actually happens, what about the risk of shooting juvenile whooping cranes, which are endangered, due to misidentification, especially if there is an inexperienced hunter?
Yeah, that's worth commenting on, and we'll probably get comments from everybody on this. Melissa, what do you think?
Well, like every time you put a weapon in anyone's hand, they should be doing it with the appropriate amount of training. At least that's the way I was schooled in hunting and shooting. This, what would be required as a part of the bill that was passed, that would require any hunter with a permit or a license to shoot sandhill cranes to attend annual sort of training or education. Just to make sure that that doesn't happen. That is a fear, because unfortunately some people shoot first and look second. So we want to make sure that anyone who is going out, if there is a hunt, has the appropriate kind of background in identification of these birds.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about the deer population here and the warnings and so forth that come out with our elk herd in the state. And
right.
Educating right. And telling people, watch out what you're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we have a number of emails I haven't gotten to. One was, and let me see if I can find it here. It had to do with a hunt. Someone suggested, and I'm just not finding it now, providing licenses for hunting only in the areas where there was depredation.
It's, So what we learned, again, if you would have asked me a year ago, what do you know about sandhill cranes? And I would say they're really cool. Now I know that the non-territorial birds travel quite distances. You have territorial breeding pairs, and they really are localized. They're not the root of the problem, at least from the data that was presented to us. It's these non-territorial, non-mating pairs, and they're going to roam. They go all over. So trying to get to the heart of that is a real challenge. Again, you're not going to hunt them in the spring, and you're not going to hunt them during that time when the colts are fledging. Really looking at a fall hunt, and that's when they all start gathering together. I remember seeing, you know, like the woman in Cable, just so many in the fields as they gather to migrate. So there's some challenges in saying, well, if this is the area where they're the most problematic, how do we best address that without harming those mating pairs, which are least problematic? Try to get those non-mating pairs who have a tendency to travel great distances to forage.
Yeah, I spent the summer at the Odana Golf Course playing golf from time to time, and there was a pair that had a young one, and I got to watch that pair and that young one grow up over the course of the summer and fall. It was really a lot of fun to watch. They pretty much stayed at Odana, I think, a golf course,
yep,
where they had plenty of help and food there for sure. And speaking of that, Walt in the town of Koshkonong says, not yet mentioned, is that cranes do a lot of good for farmers by eating pests like mice and insects.
That Todd? Is my understanding, that they like those things.
Yeah. Todd, you comment?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's lots of positive things about sandhill cranes, no doubt. And that is potentially one. But if you in the agricultural community, while that they may benefit from that piece of it, they also suffer the financial loss because of damage. So, and maybe just step back. And Melissa touched on one part of that earlier with the whooping crane question. Is for Wisconsin to establish a season, I believe it's 6 criteria outlined by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the sandhill crane education piece is one of that, along with 5 others that making sure that whatever season is established in Wisconsin is in alignment with the current plan or a future updated plan, if that hopefully occurs at some point in time. So management of a species like this is a very fluid process, and it changes with time, it changes with new data, it changes with new information. It's an ebb and flow process. And then real quickly back to the whooping crane. Obviously the loss of anyone, a whooping crane for any reason, is a bad thing. But it's also important to know that there's never been a whooping crane shot by a legal sandhill crane hunter who's hunting within the season framework, is permitted, all of that. That incident has not occurred. Have there been whooping cranes shot by hunters? Yes, but not in the structure and frame of a legal sandhill crane season.
And you know what, on that note, here we are out of time. There's so much more we could talk about. But you know what I wanted to say? I was so impressed with all three of you for the care that you obviously took. And I hope that was true for all members of the committee, that you the care you took in listening and coming up with the decisions that were made. Some were for it, some were against it, but it was obviously something that everybody considered very, very carefully. And thank you. Paul Waite, Melissa Johnson, and Todd Schaller, our guests today. And, you know, this is a topic we'll keep going back to as things progress. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. take a look at solar farms in the state. The proliferation of solar farms on our rural Wisconsin landscape, you know what, it's been welcomed by a lot of people, but it's been criticized by others. And our guests today are looking into how solar power can be generated while at the same time preserving our farmland. And a couple of guests for you. Stephen Lohide is a hydrologist and professor of civil and environmental engineering at the UW-Madison. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you with us as well. Encore Desai is our other guest today, the department chair and professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences in the UW-Madison College of Letters and Sciences. He's our weather guys that we have on from once in a while. He's the a colleague of those two fellows at Encore. Welcome to you.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me on a lovely day with a little bit of a light dusting of snow.
It's great to have you both with us. And as we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in with your questions. The field is called agrivoltaics, and we're going to get some more about that. But what do you think about the solar arrays that you're seeing these days? One's right across the road from my sister's, our family home. And it was the old Hanson farm. It's now a solar array. So we've got some firsthand experience, I could say, with a solar array. I've been pretty positive. But what about you? What are your thoughts? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Steve, let's turn to you first. Your focus is agrivoltaics. What is that exactly?
Yeah, well, you know, the idea is really pretty simple. Trying to get double duty out of the land, putting up photovoltaic arrays, which, you know, you've mentioned, you see more of them now. You know, before you might have seen a solar panel or two on someone's rooftop, but now you're starting to see big arrays kind of across different parts of the landscape. And so we're looking at, can you also get some agricultural productivity out of these lands, grow something, graze something between the rows, underneath the rows of panels?
And Encore, how did you get involved in this?
Yeah, this is a great question. I'm a climate scientist. A lot of my work is trying to understand how landscapes and ecosystems are influence and impact climate and how things like future climate change might impact their systems. I've worked with Steve on and off on a couple of projects, and it was we had this opportunity through the University of Wisconsin Research Forward and with the development of this Kagansa solar array to be able to conduct a study where we can directly look at the impacts of growing solar fields in farm areas for their ecosystem impacts and how they affect everything from the water cycle and the carbon cycle and plants and pollinators. You know, we're going to see more of these as we continue into the future. Already, about 5% of our world's energy is produced by solar power, and that's likely to quadruple in the next decade. And we understand, right, what we need for this country is to have both food and energy security. And agrivoltaics is one of the ways that we could consider looking at that into the future.
Let's talk about that research farm that Encore mentioned. Steve, maybe you can start with that. Tell us the background on that.
Yeah, so University of Wisconsin has a lot of sustainability goals. And one of those is net zero by 2050. Mm-hmm. And actually, even more so, by 2030, only 5 years out now, having all of our electricity production offset by renewable sources. And so the university has solar on some of the rooftops, for instance, at the UW Arboretum, just across the road here at Gordon Commons, but also leases some land out and supports that. So that's what's happening here at the Kagansa site is there's land that the university has owned right near the physical sciences lab that produces equipment for researchers, but the land next to it's been rented out as farmland. And so now we're going to have a solar field there
that is going to be used both to produce power that's going to go into the grid and support our energy goals, but also be used as a research facility, a sort of living lab. This has been really, you know, the Office of Sustainability has had this as part of their agenda. And we thought, what a better way to produce renewable energy, clean energy, and also learn from it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. How big is that operation that you're working on? Is it, what, 30, 40 acres or something?
No. It's a much smaller facility than that. The energy production at that site, let me see, I wrote that down. It's going to be just a couple of megawatts, and it's about 13 acres.
Yeah.
About 13?
Yeah, it's about 14 or 15 acres. And so, yeah, that 2.25 megawatts or so is enough to power like 500 homes. The idea here isn't that this is a particularly large solar farm, but it is kind of typical of some of the agrivoltaics fields we've seen around the state. And in particular, as a research site where we can kind of bring in instrumentation to be able to monitor the climate, monitor the ecosystems.
Yeah.
One of the things that's really special about it is that we're going to have different setups for the panels that we have. So there are, two kind of main types of arrays that people have. One of them is a fixed tilt. And so we live in the northern hemisphere, and the sun is kind of in the southern field of view. And so we have panels that always face to the south. And the sun rises in the east, sets in the west, but the panel is always looking towards the south. Those are, you know, what you saw in most arrays that were developed 10 years ago would have been fixed tilt. Now there's a second variety that's really, really becoming very common, especially at large scale, utility scale solar arrays, and those are single axis trackers. And so instead of facing south, the rows actually run north-south. And so the panels tilt towards the east when the sun rises and then follows it through the day and faces to the west by sunset.
Yeah, that's what we have out by Cottage Grove at the farm across the street from from the home. They tilt throughout, follow the sun throughout the day.
Kind of like a sunflower.
You know, Gus in Altoona has a question that kind of relates to that. Gus, hi. Gus, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, Gus.
Yeah, I was just looking on the Rutgers site because they have their campus all covered, their parking lots covered with solar panels, and they're looking at to put solar panel fences up so that the cattle can graze in between them. And they have bifacial panels so that when the sun comes up in the east, you get a lot of energy right away. When it's noon, you don't get hardly anything because the sun's straight up. But then in the evening, you get more sun, too. So it kind of fills in, you know, that that use of people needing energy in the morning and at night more than that. And you can still use the fields. So I thought that was pretty interesting research project that they've just started in the last year or so.
Yeah,
that's awesome. You bring up some really good points. Those are really neat systems. They have some of those in Germany too. But yeah, the idea is that essentially the panels are vertical. Mm-hmm. And so they're just like fences. And so you can much, much more easily imagine a combine going between rows of solar panels that are in that orientation. Right. But the other good point that was really raised there is that when you're producing more of the energy is in the morning when people are getting ready and need it, then midday, right, the panel's not receiving direct radiation. So you have a little bit less production there, but then it again ramps up at night when people are using more energy. So there's some better timing in terms of the production of the energy matching with people's use.
Yeah, I have to say, both Steve and I were at a conference last week in Washington, D.C. with a lot of climate scientists, including an entire session on agrivoltaics. And one of the things that was just remarkable is the range of creativity. I mean, the nice thing about a solar panel is that it's a relatively simple device when you think about it. And you can use it in a lot of different ways. And so whether a vertical panel, because it can work better on a farm, versus a parking lot panel that might be on top and provide some shade, versus some of the things we're working on here where we want to have a little bit greater row spacing so that you could have planting or grazing in addition to having being able to maximize power generation.
Vern in Eau Claire County will give you a chance to join in too. Hi, Vern.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thanks for letting me on. So on your solar panels, they're not practical. They never will be. For one, you get DC power. It takes complex electrical systems to convert to AC, and it's really not AC. It's a clipped pulse, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, you got this big solar farm. You know how much energy a battery stores? You couldn't store enough energy if you want to. And you can't have, you got to maintain, you're going to connect to the grid.
All right. So Vern's not in favor of solar at all from the sound of it, Steve.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Vern has some points here. One of the main challenges with solar getting to very high percentages is being able to store it. People want to have energy, not just in the day when the sun's out, but at night, and they want to have energy in the winter, right? And so getting to very high percentages of solar is going to be challenging until we get better battery systems available. But right now, there are lots of other sources that you can turn down the production at other facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you kind of balance that throughout the day.
Pam in Whitewater will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Pam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in Whitewater. We are getting a solar farm. It's going to be about 2,000 acres. And some of our local residents are pushing back on it because they are going to be surrounding our homes, that kind of thing, and we don't like it. And I hear a lot about the impact on the environment, the impact on the water, the impact on other things. But I never hear anything about the impact on the people who are being surrounded by these. You know, I'm going to go from a farm field on three sides of me to solar fields on three sides of me. And I feel like I'm getting moved into an industrial park. And I'm also concerned about the long-term changes. I mean, you were talking about grazing underneath and that kind of thing, and I like that idea. But the solar panels that are being put in now are going to be 8 feet off the ground, and they're going to be close enough together. And I wonder how they're going to be able to change those things as the solar things are updated.
Oh, the panels and so forth. All right. Well, what do you think, Encore?
I mean, these are important points, right? Not every, with both of the last two callers, solar is not the right solution everywhere. And thinking about not just the impacts to the local system where you're installing the panels, but also the view shed, right? And so, for example, at the Kagansa Array that we were talking about earlier, where we're partnering with Alliant Energy, a lot of the focus was also about thinking about the view and putting in additional buffers to make sure that those who want to protect what they see, as well as to kind of think about where solar panels are sited appropriately and correctly, because the impacts are not just to ecosystems and animals, but also to individuals. But that said, there is, of course, right, about two-thirds of the current U.S., that last year's U.S. New energy generation was solar. It is the fastest growing energy source in the country because it is one of the cheapest sources of energy in the country. And so we do have to get our heads around the fact that it is going to be a major part of our global energy system. And we need to think carefully about where we put these systems.
Yeah. Steve, anything to add there?
Yeah, no, the change to the viewscape is really is a real one, right? And you can do a lot with where you place it, putting it a little bit lower in the landscape, putting some tree lines to minimize the impact of neighbors. But, you know, when one comes in, often it's an individual farmer who's deciding that they want to lease out their land for often a 30-year period. And instead of farm it actively, they'll be generating some revenue through that lease. And some farmers see that as a way to rest the land and recover it and allow, you know, organic matter to build up in the soil and have the idea that, okay, I'm going to use it for solar generation for 30 years, but then I'm going to go back into farming.
Mm-hmm. Lots of interesting points here already, and we have other callers online. But I really do want to get into the nuts and bolts of your research, too, because I'm really interested in the research that you're doing on things like the drip line. I mean, you know, when water's hitting those panels, they're all coming down. If it's sort of like your house without a, if you have a house that is getting a lot of water, you might wind up with a drip line along the house. Well, that same thing could happen with solar. And I know you're researching that, and we'll get to that. Just a reminder, though, that our guests today are, Steve Lohide, hydrologist and professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison, and Ankur Desai, who is the department chair and professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. And they're working on this research project to kind of look at what are some of the impacts of a solar array on the land. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at agrivoltaic research and how crops can be cultivated under solar farms. And a couple of guests for you, Steve Lohide from the UW-Madison, a hydrologist, professor of civil and environmental engineering, Ankur Desai is the department chair of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Department. So it's great to have both of them with us. They're combining on a research project looking into this. And you can join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Before we go back to the phones, let's go to Stella in Sturgeon Bay, I think. Stella, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I've had a number of thoughts about solar panels in fields. One is somebody mentioned solar panels being mounted 8 feet high. If they're 8 feet high and if they're on these single trackers mounted on a north-south orientation and they rotate from east to west, if they are in a field that is planted with perennial forage for grazing animals, it should certainly be possible to have animals grazing under them while enough sun should get through to nourish the grasses. And it certainly, with climate change, it getting hotter and hotter every summer, shade for the animals would be very much appreciated. And another thought is if the panels are mounted lower than that and animals can't get under it, ginseng is a really important crop in Wisconsin, and it requires shade. So could that be a potential possibility, planting ginseng under solar panels?
Hmm.
Absolutely. These are both fantastic ideas. Yeah, so the mounting of the panels, when you talk about the height, that's the height at the central axis. So when it's tilted, one edge is lower than that. But certainly there is plenty of room underneath a standard solar array for animals to graze underneath it. And there is evidence that sheep that do graze do spend their time when it's sunnier underneath in the shade. Certainly heat stress is one of the factors that can reduce your meat production if you're grazing. So absolutely, that's a important consideration for agrivoltaics. Thinking about the height of the vegetation is also an important criteria when you're planning a site. If you're planning it with native pollinator habitat, for example, that's considered a form of agrivoltaics because those increased pollinators help improve productivity in surrounding fields. But you do need to make sure that the native vegetation that you're planting is not going to be tall enough that it'll provide some shade in the early hours of the morning or the late evening hours.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Ankur, you were going to add something there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, one of the original use cases for agrivoltaics actually came out in the desert Southwest where there was a very quick realization that there's plenty of shade-tolerant crops that do a lot better underneath some of these agrivoltaic systems, and in fact, they use a lot less water. And that's one of the things that we want to look at with our particular site, is that while in desert southwest regions and semi-arid locations, using less water on average is a net good, that can have other consequences in places like Wisconsin where we're already wet, and that has impacts on things like the local water table.
Yeah, so how are you studying, talk about what you're looking at in your study project on your fields.
Yeah. Go ahead. Well, go ahead.
Encore, you start.
Yeah, I'll start. with our project that we currently have, we have three of us as investigators, myself, Steve Lohide here on the show, along with Professor Chris Kosharik, who's in agroecosystem science. And the three of us each are kind of approaching this research from a couple of different angles related to our areas of expertise. So I'll let Steve talk about his, but my area of expertise is really understanding how entire fields or forests or wetlands exchange things like greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, which tell us how productive a land is, tells us how much decomposition is happening on the land. And the way we do that is this really cool technology that I've been working with for the last 20 years, where we take towers and we put instruments on the top of the tower where we directly measure something called atmospheric turbulence, or the winds that move air up and down. Mm. So you've seen gusty days and you see leaves that circle around as the air moves around them. Well, that air isn't moving more than just leaves. It's actually also moving the gases like water, like carbon dioxide, that leave or enter plants and then enter or leave the atmosphere. And so we measure that 20 times a second on top of a tower, in this case over the solar array. And from that, we can back out how much productivity is happening underneath this array, how much water we're losing over the entire system as a whole. And so with our current experiment, we have two. I was just out there yesterday mucking my way through the mud as they were building the site. And I think we're going to put one of these towers in the middle of the array, and we're going to put basically one in a field that's more of a typical rotation crop, where we'll be able to kind of compare and contrast the change in productivity and the change in evaporation that we'll see over this site.
That's pretty cool. Steve, what are you up to?
Yeah, well, when you start talking about the hydrologic response, that's when I get interested. And so, you know, the thing that I studied, and if you think about it, even before you have a solar panel, right, it's the movement of water across and through the landscape. And so precipitation falls, you have a rainstorm. Most of that's going to infiltrate into the soil. If it's an intense rainstorm or lasts long enough, you might have some start to accumulate on the land surface and then run off. And that's what would cause flooding. Yeah. Or storm response. It's eventually going to reach the streams and create flooding issues potentially. But most of it enters the soil. And once it's in the soil, then the plant roots take it up and use it for evapotranspiration. In Wisconsin, rough numbers, 2/3 of the precipitation that we get is returned to the atmosphere through evapotranspiration.
Oh, didn't know that.
yeah, it's surprising for a lot of people.
So how are you? So what are you actually doing there as part of the study? I mean, how are you figuring out this business? With
yeah,
water?
So we're monitoring the soil moisture, and that changes when you have a solar array in two predominant ways. One, you have the panels themselves. So rain hits the panel and then ends up focused at the drip line. So you have a lot more rain landing in a pretty small area. And you're going to have wetter soils there, potentially that water moving deeper in, maybe even replenishing our groundwater systems. The other major effect that we see at solar arrays is that the plants are in the shade a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Say they don't receive as much energy to drive that evapotranspiration of water. It takes a lot of energy to change water in from the liquid phase to the vapor phase. We know that when we sweat, we cool off. It's because it's requiring some energy for that process. And the plants aren't getting as much when they're in the shade. So that means that water has to go somewhere. Maybe it becomes that surface water runoff, or maybe it becomes groundwater recharge.
So, and that's what you're looking at, how much of it is recharge and how much is going straight down.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's take some, we got callers online with questions. Dick in Black River Falls will go to you, then we'll get to Andy in La Crosse. But Dick, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I just loved hearing what Steve had to say there. It's so positive. And my comment is to the people who think that it's so obscene to see windmills and that kind of thing, solar panels on roofs. My take on it is, you know, way back in the 30s when the power poles came in across the country, people had to change and adapt to that then. And now we see huge power poles right in our communities. We can't drive through a town without seeing huge power lines. And how obscene is that? And yet we accept it. You say, oh, that's the power. We got to have it. And I just think that the windmills are such a positive thing to see, getting free energy. And we have all these people who are trying to do it right. So I'm 77. Change is hard for all of us. But it's such a beautiful thing to know that it's a positive change. That's my only comment.
Oh, Dick, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Encore, you just want to make a comment on that?
Yeah, I appreciate your point. This is part of our research goal as well, which is broadly there is the ability to develop tools that can help us understand where it is appropriate to site renewable energy sources from a variety of considerations for the environment, for local communities, for agriculare. And in fact, for example, I work some with the Nature Conservancy, which has been developing a site renewables right tool that's focused on the conservation aspects and where renewable energy installation would have the most benefit, but also the most protection of the environment for where they go in.
Thank you again, Steve. Appreciate that call. Andy in La Crosse will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Yeah, I guess I have a question about, and I don't know all the logistics behind setting the solar panels up, and it really doesn't pertain to what your guests with their water runoff stuff, but is there a reason why we don't utilize, like, parking lots and such that seem to be such open spaces, and it would, like, you know, shade the lots so they don't get so hot, but maybe it's a height issue or something with that.
Okay, solar panels on parking lots. Mm-hmm. Steve?
Yeah, no, that is being done in a fair number of places. I worked for a year at the Desert Research Institute, and there were solar panels there over the parking lot. And it was kind of nice to be able to park your car in the shade if you live in Nevada. In Wisconsin, we have some more considerations with snow and snow loading above the cars that are parking under it. But there's certainly some potential there to have more solar over parking lots and also on buildings.
And there are, Joel was just reminding me, there are solar arrays over parking lots on the Epic campus in Verona.
That's right. That's right. And like, when it comes to solar, you kind of have to think about the kind of three main ways that we think about solar installations and power, right? There's residential solar, putting solar panels on your house, generating power locally, maybe selling some back to the grid, and that provides a power for maybe one home. And then there's commercial-grade solar. So these are the things where an individual company or a group wants to put solar panels, say, over a parking lot. And that provides power potentially for being able to offset some of the energy use. But really, with those things don't have the scale to, say, go up to something like utility-scale solar, where really what we want to do is be able to generate power for hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of homes and communities. And that's really where some of the agrivoltaics kind of provides a potential solution beyond kind of having very, very large solar arrays that use up land and solely for solar.
Yeah. And there are solar farms in, I think, Fitchburg and Cashton and Fond du Lac, where they have sheep grazing with them. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but I would think there'd be some environmental benefits to solar grazing, I guess you'd call it. Steve?
Yeah. Solar grazing is definitely one of the really big hot topics that people are thinking about. There was a study out of Oregon that showed that growing forage underneath solar panels in their climate actually ended up producing more and higher quality forage than if you were just growing it in an open field. And the reason for that was in that climate, it's pretty dry summers. And so the reduced evapotranspiration for vegetation underneath the panels during the summer allowed the growing season essentially to last longer out there, right? They didn't they didn't run out of water, so the plants kept growing. So, there's been a big move towards that. And in Wisconsin, there are several places that we have grazing underneath panels. And the ranchers who are engaging in this follow kind of a spectrum of different business models, from having an array that they have their sheep at. Yep. And they, you know, have fences between the different rows so that it's small allotment and they can mob graze the sheep. They go there for a short time, then move on to the next one. And after you do that with the grass, then the grasses grow back and recover pretty quickly. So you can get a lot of productivity off of a, you know, relatively modest sized piece of land.
And I did, I saw a piece, an article somebody wrote on one of the sheep farmers, and he said the sheep like it. They can get in the shade if they want to and lay down, and they might rub against it a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, so they like it. And the other way that the sheep ranchers are making a living is not only raising the sheep, but also getting paid for vegetation management. So usually at these solar arrays, you have to bring in someone to mow the grass, take care of the weeds, keep it up. In dry environments, you worry about dry grasses and fire risk associated. So there's vegetation management needs that the sheep are actually providing. And so some of those farmers are taking their sheep from one array to the next and performing that vegetation management service.
I know the one guy had thought about, he had sheep, but he had thought about beef, but then learned about the sheep. And so, I mean, are there other animals that might work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So sheep kind of has been the sweet spot. Yeah. The goats.
No goats.
People are worried about the goats are curious. And so they like to chew things, rub at things. And so people are very skeptical of putting goats on. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's why people prefer sheep. But there is a big push for cattle as well. And in fact, there's this lasso competition right now, large animal solar system operations. It's an America-made challenge. And it's the idea of getting cattle grazing integrated with solar arrays. The concern being that cattle are a much larger animal. Yeah. And so they can rub up against and potentially damage some of the equipment.
Yeah, you got an 800-pound animal leaning up against your solar array. You probably don't want that.
Yeah. That's going to take some engineering challenges for sure.
And some height issues. Yeah. I would guess that those would be higher. The poles would be higher, so they'd be further up.
So that is I mentioned that we had the south-facing at the Kaganza site. We'll have the south-facing panels. We'll have the single-axis trackers. But then we'll also have a set of high-elevated fixed panels. Okay. And so those will be high enough that, you know, people could garden underneath without worrying about hitting their head.
Okay, so at least 6 feet, 8 feet maybe.
Yeah. So you can think about that maybe being for like something like, a farmer's market producer who might grow crops integrated within an array.
Yeah, I was thinking about vegetables. Could you do vegetable farmers? Could that work?
Yeah, absolutely. As we were just talking about, some of these higher elevated arrays can kind of work well where you need folks working on the ground with vegetables and not having to have the panels in the way. As I've learned very directly, solar panels don't feel good when you hit your head on them. There's definitely some ways that you can kind of work around with different designs to be able to have vegetable production. At the Kagansa Array, yes, as Steve mentioned, there's this one area with elevated panels. And part of that is also for education, in that we can have people come and walk through and underneath. The goal of this array is not just a research farm, but also to be a demonstration site where as the site gets into full hour operation, individuals and groups can come out, meet with some of the team members, learn a little bit more about what would it take to be able to do agrivoltaics on their own operations, or just to learn generally about the energy industry and some of the partnerships that we have with Alliant Energy and other energy companies like Madison Gas and Electric.
Somebody else was wondering in an email, how would llamas or emus do on solar farms? Yeah, I have no idea, but they're not like goats, I don't think.
Yeah, something to look into. I've heard it. I've heard that suggested too, and also chickens.
Yeah, why not with chickens?
Yeah.
I can see that as an issue. Well, we're talking about solar here and some research that's being done on the UW by UW researchers, Steve Lohide and Ankur Desai, two of many others who are working on this, relating to having solar and crops in the same spot. You can join in too with your questions or comments. We got some emails. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can phone. So open lines get you on pretty quickly with your thoughts on solar at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Big thanks to everybody who donated during our year-end member drive. It's support from people like, Bruna in Platteville, or Jolene in Chippewa Falls, or Nancy in Tomahawk, among others who contributed during our year-end member drive. And if you missed joining in, still time to do it at WPR.org. I got some of those wool socks when I added to my contributions. When you do this, even still now, you can get those socks if you're willing to contribute $15 a month or more, and you'll be playing an important role in keeping us informed, inspired, and connected. And, of course, thanks for your participation. Right now, talking with Stephen Lohide, a hydrologist and professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW, and Ankur Desai, who is department chair and professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have both of them with us. They're combining with another researcher on looking at solar panels and how crops might be cultivated under solar farms. They're looking at water and the atmospheric conditions that may be created around solar panels. Join in, number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Rolf and Hayward emailed to say, well, you can live near big open spaces like a farm field or solar farm. It may be not always a choice, but farm fields often become massive housing or industrial developments. Which would you rather have access to? So there's a comment from Rolf. And Brad emailed to ask if you have looked at alternative sightings of solar arrays, such as over highways, possibly reducing snow plowing or reducing glare on sunny days. Any of that work being done that you know of, Stephen?
Yeah, there is work. We're not working on that exactly, but there is work being done on that. You know, for instance, one of the ideas is for like irrigation canals. Putting the panels over the canals or over sections of streams so that the water doesn't heat up. Because if that water is returned to a natural stream and it's at an elevated temperature, it's really bad for the aquatic ecosystems and the fish. And so thinking about that, photovoltaics is another term that's out there, putting them on lakes or on the ocean where, you know, they might not be as visible to folks.
Amy in Cumberland has a question. Amy, hi.
Hi. My question is, instead of putting all the solar panels and fields in on acres, why wouldn't, being that most of them are subsidized or paid for by the government, why wouldn't we put one on every house rooftop?
All right. Why wouldn't we put one on every house? Well, there's some houses that, mine, for example, where I can't because of the trees.
Right.
That's the same for mine, actually. I tried, yeah. But I have too much shade. We live in an old neighborhood with really well-established trees, and so we get a lot of shade. That's one thing. But residential solar is certainly a piece of the puzzle, and there is a lot of growth in that industry as well. You do have to connect it to the grid still, so you have to integrate the solar that you're producing with the electricity that you're going to get, so that you have power at night.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of benefit for rooftop solar, and there are programs to be able to have evaluate your home and to be able to look at things like resources from Renew Wisconsin and elsewhere. But when it comes to just broadly thinking about this energy transition and being able to have homegrown energy grown here in the United States, we have to look at all possible options of where we can have energy produced.
Amy, thanks again. Ethan in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Ethan.
Hello, my name is Ethan Kellogg. I'm a senior undergraduate student in the AOS department at UW-Madison. And my question is, what role do solar panels and agrivoltaics play in low-income and developing communities?
Oh, solar and low income, and also in developing countries.
Yeah. Hey, and hi, Ethan. It's good to hear from you. There's a lot of interesting questions about this, right? It is, as Steve was mentioning, when we have solar panels, this is a way for farmers, in the case of agrivoltaics, to generate additional income through leasing with power companies. Certainly communities and community solar is an option in some communities that are looking for a way to generate some income security while generating local energy. Certainly in the developing world, there's a lot of interest in kind of leapfrogging in terms of growing their energy demand in the same way that the way that cell phone revolution allowed for the businesses and economies of many countries to grow rapidly. We're seeing something similar in that you don't need a lot of background and expertise to get a few solar panels together and wire them up and generate some power. And next thing you know, you put some stuff together and you're able to do a lot more than you could before.
Yeah, all good points. Ethan, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Gene in Menominee, we'll go to you next. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Yes, we looked into putting solar panels up, and we did. And we looked at tracking, and from what we could see, it's problematic to have tracking in our winter climates. They tend to break, whereas we installed just a simple tilt on our panels so that in the wintertime it's nearly vertical. In the summertime, it's almost flat. And that also puts the panels out of harm's way with the animals during the time when the grass is productive in the summertime. They're up high, whereas in the wintertime, when you don't have the animals out there, they're down low.
No. Comment on that, Steve?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Single-axis trackers have really become kind of the most common for the large utility scale. But there are moving parts, and moving parts break, and so there is more maintenance. But that's why at the large scale it kind of makes sense. You're going to have people out there checking on it, fixing, doing maintenance. For the small scale, that's a harder thing to manage. And so sometimes the fixed tilt is the better option. And certainly if you have the ability to manually tilt that so that it has a different angle in the summer and winter, you're getting some of the benefit, but without the extra moving parts.
Yeah, that makes sense. Gene, thank you for calling and letting us know how you're doing it. Dorothy in Nakusa, your turn. Hi, Dorothy.
Well, I have a question. We have a large solar farm near us, and from what I've heard, it has a life expectancy of like 25 to 30 years, and then they move on. Are they going to keep moving on and just gobbling up more land to install more panels? Why have I not heard anything about reusing the same land and just replacing the panels?
Oh, I think that's being done, isn't it, Steve? Yeah.
Yep. Sometimes the panels are being replaced. And in fact, you know, what's really enabled this increase in the amount of solar arrays is the decreased cost and improved efficiency. From 2010 to 2020, the cost of large-scale solar decreased 82%. And that's why it's coming to Wisconsin, right? Solar used to exist in the Southwest. There's a lot more available energy, right? It's further south and it's less cloudy. And so the potential to generate electricity is higher there. That's why it came to Wisconsin a little bit later, but it's growing really rapidly now. Though, if you look at the footprint, I saw from Renew Wisconsin an estimate that if we were to try to meet our current electricity demands all with solar, it would take about 250,000 acres, which is less than 2% of the agricultural lands that we have in the state.
And there is a very large farm. I think the largest farm, isn't it, Encore, that's coming in?
The recently approved from the Public Service Commission is the Vista Sands Solar Project. So this is a 9,500-acre agrivoltaic facility. This is across multiple farms through primarily the central Sands region of Wisconsin. That one is expected to generate close to 1.3 gigawatts of electricity. So that's about 500 times larger than what we're talking about at our research site.
How many homes is that?
That's 200,000 homes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and that's in the process.
That's just been approved.
Yeah. So they're going to be going on that pretty quickly. Well, your research, how you've just kind of been going on this a short time, right? Or how long is
project? We have one full field season under our belt. But we actually did this at a few other sites around the state. Up in New Lisbon, Black River Falls, and Middleton, we have sites because our site at Caganza just got installed this fall. And so we were kind of ready to go before the site was.
Yeah, it's the reality of construction, for sure.
And those towers, and they'll be going in. Do you have towers at the other sites too?
We did not put out towers at the other sites.
So this will be really interesting then to see how this all...
This will be unique. It is based on my analysis, I believe it will be the first of this type of tower measurement over a solar field in the entire U.S. and probably the second in the world. So it'll be a pretty unique measurement to be able to understand.
And how long will, how long before you get some findings that you're going to be really interested in?
Well, I'm excited about, as we get things going this winter into summer, I'd be very excited to see where we are about 6 months from now. And we'll start to see some of the impacts, being able to compare productivity. And of course, as we have another full season, we'll try to understand what's going on. But I'm really looking forward to it. We did some other fun projects. I know, as Steve mentioned, some of these other solar fields. It was not just research. We also had some opportunity to take students out to this field. I taught an atmospheric and oceanic sciences course at the site in Middleton, where we got the students to deploy some measurements in partnership with Madison Gas and Electric to look at microclimate impacts. And it's been really fun. These are also great learning opportunities for our students here at the university.
I would believe that, and I want to thank you both. We'll have to get you back here once you've got some data, another, say, a year from now. We'll all sit down together, and we'll do this again. Thank you both so much.
Fantastic. Thank you, Larry. It'd be great to give an update.
Yep, love it.
Steve Lohide, hydrologist and professor of civil and environmental engineering at the UW, and Encore Desai, department chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest. Boy, interesting stuff going on, isn't there? Thanks so much for tuning in today. Got a great team, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for being with us. And tomorrow we'll be looking at books that our WPR staff are recommending. Thanks for being with us.